From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for joining me, as always, for the weekly wrap-up of Connections. If you're a regular listener, you know Evan and I choose some of the standout moments from the talk show each week and replay them on this podcast so you can hear them again or listen to them for the first time. In this edition, we're highlighting personal stories. We heard some powerful ones this week, and we'll start with a story that is both tragic and heroic. Jeremy Glick died heroically in the 9/11 attacks. He was on board United Flight 93, and he was one of the passengers who attempted to thwart the hijackers. He's being posthumously inducted in the Rochester Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. Glick was a national collegiate judo champion who attended the University of Rochester and was well-loved there. In this clip, you'll hear Jeremy's father, Lloyd. He says while the pain of losing his son will never go away, he wants to share Jeremy's story. Let's listen.
The old adage about time helping, all right, it doesn't take away any of the pain or anguish, but it does kind of over time relieve that acute sense of loss, and it becomes like a dull ache, all right? And with that process, all right, it definitely becomes easier, although it's still difficult. I mean, we were pretty close, so it is difficult. But nevertheless, given the opportunity, yes, I like to talk about Jeremy.
Sure, and we're going to spend the bulk of our time here today beyond talking about 9/11, and I think that that's appropriate. To kind of get this out of the way, it's important, I think, that people understand that so much of the legend that we do hear about that day, as far as we can tell, I mean, those things really happened, that Jeremy and a group of passengers made that almost impossibly brave decision in that moment, didn't they?
No, they... What is unique is they actually took a vote, all right? Talk about democratic tradition. They took a vote to say, hey, should we do this or should we not do? And they voted overwhelmingly to say, yes, we're going to do that. And at that point, there was a considerable amount of planning. This was not something that, oh, let's go rush the cockpit, and they went off and did it. They did a lot of planning in terms of who would do what objects they had available to them could be used as weapons. So, for example, one of the things they used was the coffee service cart. And the cabin attendants actually brewed boiling water to use as a weapon. They fashioned or took anything they had, and they planned how they were going to go about it, because there were a couple of people out of the cockpit. And the objective, we know this because they told us this, the objective was to prevent the aircraft from reaching its planned target. And we know almost positively from work that the FBI did that the target was the Capitol, all right? And they picked this particular day because there was going to be a joint session later in the day, and therefore almost all the members of Congress would be present. And since they were having an international guest, the Supreme Court was also invited. So they expected that they would have almost the entire legislature, a significant part of the executive branch, and members of the Supreme Court. So if they had reached their destination at that point and succeeded in crashing the plane into the Capitol, at that point, the United States would have lost the greater part of its government. So the objective was to take control, prevent the plane from reaching its destination, and theoretically, all right, if they managed to overcome all of the hijackers, including the ones in the cockpit, perhaps attempt to land the plane. I mean, that was the plan. And they got at least the most important part of it done, right? They prevented the plane from reaching its target.
Boy, did they ever. And Lloyd, you know, the way you tell the story, it is gripping. And I'm struck by the fact that here you are as the father of one of these heroic people on that flight telling the story rather calmly. How long did it take you to be able to do that?
Longer than it should have. All right. I made a mistake, and anybody else who suffers a tragic loss, all right, I urge them sincerely to seek professional help. I didn't do that, and in retrospect, it was a mistake. All right, maybe it was through some sort of machismo ideal. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just due to an overwhelming sense of inability to act. But whatever it was, that was a mistake. So I didn't seek professional help. And I would say it probably took, you know, 3 to 4 years, right, before I literally could function. I was not really functioning the way I should have been able to afterwards for, you know, that extended period of time. So in retrospect, it took me much longer than it should have.
The Glick family will be in Rochester on June 2nd for the Rochester Jewish Sports Hall of Fame induction ceremony at the JCC. Next, a young man with autism joined us to share his story about transitioning from high school into the working world. That transition can be challenging for anyone, but it can be especially daunting for young adults with intellectual disabilities who may need assistance with housing, medical care, and job training. Jake Collier is a self-advocate who volunteers with the nonprofit Autism Up. He says he was shy as a kid and sometimes ate lunch alone at school. But he says that experience taught him something, and he pushed himself to make connections and form relationships with his peers and people in the community. Here's Jake.
I stumbled upon Autism Up. Actually, it came across as a winter storm warning of all the places that closed.
Ah.
So I found it on the banner at the bottom of the screen, and I was like, what is that? So I went and checked it out, and I took a couple classes. And next thing you know, I really loved the cause and what they were doing there, and I wanted to volunteer, and I asked if they had anything I could do, and they had lots I could do, and just continued to grow from there, that relationship.
I love that story of a snowstorm change in your life.
Yeah, pretty much.
So you see the word autism up. What does autism mean in your life?
For me, it all comes back to diversity and humanity. And I think that we all struggle with different things in life, and we all want to be accepted, and we all want to be independent. And sometimes it doesn't always come across the way you'd expect it would, but...
And can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by the way things come across? When you were trying to communicate one thing, and we want whoever we're speaking to receive it a certain way, if it doesn't come across, tell me about what you mean by it doesn't always come across.
I think that, well, I look at it as I used to be really shy, like all the time, and I had trouble looking people in the eye, and I think that came across to people as, you know, I didn't want to forge relationships. I didn't want to be a part of something great. I kind of just wanted to be left alone, and that was okay with me and everyone else. But the truth of the matter is I just kind of needed that nudge, and I needed some people to search for the good in me and, you know, sit with that other kid at lunch who's sitting alone and just be there for them and find the good in them.
Oh, this is just amazing stuff. It really is so powerful to hear this. What did it feel like, especially in those days where you didn't quite have that nudge yet, and so people you were encountering might have been judging you, might have been thinking, he doesn't want to talk to me, he doesn't want to have a relationship, or maybe even he's acting rude. When those things were happening, how were you then internalizing and thinking about it?
Well, it's hard because when I feel that way, it makes you feel even more distant, and like you don't want to continue trying to pursue anything, and you just kind of want to go off and be on yourself by yourself. But the truth is, I really want to share what I have to offer with other people, and I think they deserve to see that in me, and I can offer a lot to them.
And when you might have been sitting alone at lunch, for example, you know, I mean, what's it like?
Well, it's not fun. You know, it's taught me a lot, and in the sense that because I know from experience how frustrating it can be to go and sit with somebody else who's sitting at lunch, because I know how that would make someone's day to know that somebody took interest in them, and regardless of who they are and what background they come from, somebody was interested in them and wanted to know about them. And just, it's a great feeling to feel like you're not alone, because we're all human and we don't want to be alone. We all want to be a part of something.
And so here you are now. You recently spoke, what, to hundreds of people? Is that right?
Yeah, the recent Autism Up Gala.
I mean, if I would have told the Jake from 10 years ago that you were going to do that, do you think you would have believed it?
No, of course not.
So let's talk a little bit about what kind of the steps, because that doesn't happen overnight. What were some of the nudges? How did those things start to happen for you to get you to feel a little bit more comfortable and maybe in interactions, whether it's making eye contact or responding in different ways? What was happening?
Well, for me, it's really doing your homework and getting confident. I was really controlled by fear and anxiety most of my life. I always assumed if I went up and talked to someone, I might like assume the worst, like maybe I'd be bothering them or they wouldn't want to talk to me. So then I wouldn't try it at all. But after some time, I decided, again, I wanted to make relationships with other people, and I was going to go that extra mile and take some chances, go out there and reach out and say hi to someone, ask them about the weather, try to make eye contact with them and try to, you know, observe how they react to different situations and kind of take that on myself.
When you start doing that, and it takes the effort, you're almost kind of like training a new muscle that I'm gonna ask them and I'm gonna respond instead of shutting down. Does it slowly over time become just more natural to do that?
Yeah, it definitely does. And I like how you called it a muscle, because that really is how it is. It's like a new reflex. You know, you start off thinking, you know, I can't do this and I don't want to do it. But after you do it more and more, it starts to get more natural. And now I'm, you know, it just comes naturally. I say good morning to everyone.
He is a remarkable young man, and as many of our listeners pointed out, a fantastic communicator. Jake graduated from high school, and he's working in Rochester now. He's also doing public presentations about his story, and he hopes that he can inspire other people who have autism. We'll end the week with a story about questioning one's religion. Earlier this month, popular Christian writer Rachel Held Evans died suddenly at the age of 37. Evans was raised in the Evangelical Church, but then left it after questioning its perspectives. She joined the Episcopalian Church and became a voice for Christians who didn't want to leave their faith, but openly questioned parts of it. Our guests on Connections were inspired by her work, and they joined us to discuss their faith journeys. In this clip, you'll hear Shawnee Wilson, a physician's assistant at Trillium Health. Evan asked Shawnee if there was a specific moment that made her doubt her church or its teachings. Here's what she said.
It was when I went to PA school. I went to PA school here locally at RIT, and I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was gay, and I remember talking to her about hell, and she just started crying, and she's like, I don't want to go to hell. You know, she's like, I'm a person that loves my friends. I love my mom, my family. And we were taking a philosophy of religion class, or like a philosophy class together, and we were just talking about it. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, this person is like one of my really good friends, and I really care about her a lot. And the people that I go to church with, whom don't really know me, aren't as close as I am to her. And I've gone through a lot of things personally, and she was there every time. You know, when I had a trouble and my house was broken into, this person was the first one that came to my home. You know, I am in school with her. Like, I resonate with her so much more than I do with the people that I'm supposed to be in community with and faith community with. But this is my faith. This is my person. And if she's sitting here crying and telling me how she doesn't want to go to hell, I was like, oh my gosh, like, what is it that I'm thinking here? Like, what is it that I think that, you know, what is it that I'm thinking as far as like her being better than me, as far as like racking up enough to get into the, in, like, if I do enough and say enough and rack up enough points or formula, or do it, you know, in a formula, that my formula is going to get me into heaven, and her formula is not. And when I really started to actually wrote my paper about it, my paper that year, because it just, for some reason, it just really struck me, because I just couldn't reconcile that. I really couldn't. It had to, and the thing was reconciling, right? I couldn't, you know, put everything together, and it didn't make sense. Like, it literally did not make sense. So that was my thing.
But when it didn't make sense in that your faith didn't make sense to you, that this person would be excluded from sort of what you had been promised in an afterlife, or your faith didn't make sense to the point where you doubted the entire foundations of it.
So I would say both. I think the thing was, is that I'm watching this person, you know, this person that I really sincerely care about, crying because she's so afraid of hell. And this is like a deep fear that you can only see on somebody's face, right? Mm. You know, that's what I'm saying. That's what I questioned first, because I couldn't understand why a God who loves everybody and who loves me, and, you know, the Bible tells me all these things about myself that are wonderful, and this person, would cause this person to have such an internal crisis and to have such a display of emotion. Because she never cried in front of me before. But that's what was coming up out of her. And that, you know, she was telling me, hey, I don't want to go to hell. You know, I don't want to go to that place. So why, what have I done to do that? So that was the reason for the questioning. Did it question my entire foundation? Yes. Because I had grown up in a place, that evangelical place, it was very much like us versus them and otherizing other people. And so when I saw that, I was like, well, this person's closer to me than these other folks. So, you know, what's, like, I really had to just step back and just really look at things differently.
Okay. And then when you could have scrapped the entire foundation, or at least you're starting to apparently scrap parts of it,
mm-hmm.
how did you either decide or feel yourself saying, I built this house, or I the community with me built this house. I'm tearing down parts of it that don't feel right, but I'm not tearing down the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to rebuild it.
So I think the thing was, for me, it was more, it was foundational, but it was also like the actual wood paneling of the house, you know, like some of that. So I couldn't actually, like, this took years, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, we're talking about deconstructionism and reconstruction, whatever you choose to do, or whatever journey you are, if you're questioning or non-questioning, you were talking about not just foundational, you were actually talking about how the house is built and what's in it, not the furniture, but the actual house itself. And so when I looked back at my house, I saw that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't keep it, and it all had to go. Because especially in the political climate we were in, where other people, like, you know, I'm a Black woman, I'm a physician assistant, there's not a lot of people like me. And so for me, I definitely resonated with her and her grief and misunderstanding, because I had people misunderstanding me for what I look like, you know, and judging me for what, from where I come from or what I look like. So I had to actually, like, take out this wood paneling that said this. I had to take out another wood paneling that said that in my mind, you know, in my mind frame. And so when I looked back at the house, it was holes everywhere, and it didn't stand on its own, you know. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about rebuilding. You know, we talk about, like, you know, I had people in my life that I really love and trusted from, you know, evangelicalism that I went to. I went to Bible college. And so I knew that they wouldn't accept what I was saying, but I had to say it because it was wrong. And I couldn't, like, with the non-reconciling, you know, I couldn't, like I couldn't keep those relationships or maintain those relationships, which was devastating. But I also knew that, you know, when I looked at the holes and I said, this is what Rachel said, you guys, I'm trying, there's an existential crisis, because there is, you know, my house is a giant, like, my house is broken. My house is on the ground. How am I going to build this? You know? And when somebody looks at you and walks away and like, well, I see that, but okay. And they walk the other way. It's like, you're just kind of left there.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. A shout out to our colleagues Greg and Kelly over there at WEOS. We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks so much for joining me. We will talk to you next week. Have a great weekend.